Hello and welcome. My name is Julie Clegg and this is World Class Investigator, the podcast for those of you who want to rise to the top of your profession, build an influential global network of like-minded professionals, and create a legacy of integrity and excellence. I'm glad you're here. And once again, it's time to take another step in your journey towards becoming truly world class. Hello and welcome to the World Class Investigator podcast. I'm Julie Clegg and today I'm joined by David Vidaset. A little bit about you, David. You spent 20 years in the police, including counter-terrorist operations and organized crime. David was the lead detective in the intelligence cell during the 7/7 London bombings investigations. David's been awarded several police commendations, including one for outstanding detective work and perseverance, which led to his discovery of a 7/7 bomb factory. There's lots more experience that you have there, David. I'm going to leave it to you to just introduce yourself to everybody and tell everyone a little bit more about your experience and knowledge.
Yeah, sure. I worked at Scotland Yard for many years. I use that experience now really in the work that I do. I work in security operations and in the personal protection industry outside the police. And I commentate for and about crime for the police on media and television. I'm also an author. And I use the experience that I gained as a result of working in organised crime and counterterrorism to tell my stories with my protagonist, Jake Flanagan. I wrote my first book in 2015 and published it, and that was The Thesis Paradox. And it's really an insider look at the investigation and all the things that went wrong with the 7/7 investigation. And that's where I am right now.
Wow, that's fascinating. It sounds like there's just so much to talk about and so much experience that you have there. I'd like to just dig into your experience a little bit and just get that in a little bit more detail, that I think it's really helpful to people to understand how our experts got into the investigation field and what it was specifically about that field that made you choose that. So tell us a little bit about how you became an investigator.
When my father was a police officer, and I guess growing up, you know, policing was really in my blood. You know, I have several members of my family that were in the police as well. When I was, you know, I grew up and I had quite a funny childhood because we lived in police married quarters, and this police married quarters was in the middle of a huge council estate. So really, I grew up on a huge council estate, but it was a little bit more tricky for me than most of the kids on this particular estate, because everybody knew that I was a copper's son, and so all of us that were, you know, together, we were only about 10 or 12 houses on the middle of this estate, and we really had to have all wits about us, because you're like, oh, you're the copper's kids, aren't you? So we were the target of everything, you know, burglaries and car break-ins and attacks for, you know, just simply by playing cricket on the field outside our house. So it was quite eventful. So I guess there's policing was in my blood. I didn't intend on perhaps being a police officer, but because I have this drive and tenacity in me, and I believe that I can actually do anything that I want. The careers officer sat me down one day and I was about to leave school and said, what do you want to do when you leave school? I said, well, I'm not sure yet, but I'm thinking maybe I'll be an astronaut. And then he laughed at me and he's like, you can't be an astronaut. And I said, well, why not? Why can't I be an astronaut? And he said, well, what about a fighter pilot? Can I be a fighter pilot? And he laughed at that as well. I said, okay, I'll keep it a bit more realistic. Can I be a secret agent? And he basically laughed me out of the office. But I tried a number of different jobs when I left school, and none of them were astronaut, secret agent, or fighter pilot, sadly. And I found myself a bit bored, and I applied to join the police, and I got in. I went to training school, learned all the things that you needed to learn to be a uniform police constable. We were kicked out on the streets as they do, and that's really where you start learning your trade. But quite quickly, I realised that I wanted to be an investigator. I wanted to be somebody that really sort of delved into what was going on, you know, because as a uniformed police constable, you very rarely get to see too much of the crime. You know, you turn up and report it, and then that gets given to an investigator or normally a detective to investigate. So quite quickly, I realised that I wanted to be a detective, but it was about 1996. I was inside a building in Greenwich where I worked at the time, in uniform, just doing an ordinary late shift as you do. And the IRA bombed Canary Wharf, which was just half a mile away from where I was. It was a massive explosion. I've never heard anything like it in my life. You know, bear in mind, I was inside and the windows shook and the doors shook and the whole building shook and we were half a mile away. And straight away, the guy that I was with said that was a bomb. And I'd never heard a bomb go off before. You know, I didn't know what it was. And I said, well, how do you know it's a bomb? And he said, well, you know, I've heard bombs go off and that was a bomb. And it quite came on our radio that there'd been a huge explosion in Canary Wharf. And so we made our way there. And two people had been killed. But I was fascinated by what I saw when I got there. And there were, you know, massive skyscrapers and buildings that had been literally moved off of their foundations. Massive lorry bomb that had done it. But it was more than that. It's like the way the blast was almost like a beast, as it were. You know, the way the blast had moved around this area, it had gone in, it had left some windows completely intact, but then it had gone inside the building through one window, completely wrecked the inside of the building, and then pulled out the other side of this building. But I was fascinated by it. By what I saw, and it was there and then I decided I didn't just want to be a detective investigating normal crime. I actually wanted to catch the people that did this stuff. You know, I went to hunt down the IRA and find out and catch them, really. And it was that's when I decided I wanted to join the anti-terrorist branch, and that's when I sort of set my goals on what do I need to do to get there. And that's how I started on the path to be an investigator, really. And I worked my way through all of, in London, we work in boroughs, so it's based on borough-based police. And I did all the normally investigative tasks that you could do on a borough, you know, your sort of attempted murders and GBHs, burglaries, robberies of all different sorts, and domestic violence, so all of those sorts of things. I spent some years working through those, and then somebody approached me to work in organised crime, and I went to work in organised crime, and then eventually, I got the knock to say, do you want to work in counter-terrorism or anti-terrorist branch? It was then, and I was like, wow, you know what? That is exactly what I want to do. So that was in 2004, and I'd been in the police over 10 years. At that time, and I was qualified as a detective, and I went to work at the anti-terrorist branch, and then sadly, you know, just a few months later, whilst I was again sitting inside a police building, 52 people were murdered in London, and by four suicide bombers, and it was a day that I will absolutely never forget.
Yeah, I mean, your journey to that point is fascinating, the way that you decided that, you know, I tend to find with the people that I talk to, and myself included, that everybody has a defining moment in their life or in their career that steers them in a certain direction and makes them decide, you know, where it is exactly they need to be. And I don't think you can manufacture that moment. I don't think you can create it. It just happens. You know, I have my own moment, the things that happened to me that made me decide to become a police officer. And you were already in that, career. You know, you were on the path that you'd chosen, but you had a defining moment that forced you in a certain direction or made you pursue a certain direction. And you got there just in time by the sound of it. So you got there to be a lead investigator and to be intrinsically involved in the 7/7 bombing investigation. So I would love to hear about that investigation. I'd love to hear your recollection of that day and how you ended up being involved in that, and just what that what it was like to be on an investigation of that scale, and you know, the atmosphere in that office and how that progressed.
Yeah, well, oddly that day, 7th of July, was Thursday morning. We had hardly anybody in the office, believe it or not. The Yanchere branch was quite small at that time. There was only 80 or 100 of us in there, and that might sound like a big unit, but in terms of what we did, it was actually quite small, because we had like a national responsibility. I'd been working on some surveillance operation, looking at somebody totally unconnected with 7/7, and I was reviewing some surveillance footage of this, what we'd been doing to try and work out our next steps, really. And we had a big TV on the wall that beamed in Sky News, so we could see what was going on. And I saw this news flash come up that there'd been an electrical explosion on the tube. I'd lived in London most of my life, and I'd never heard of an electrical explosion before. And then it came up, there was multiple electrical explosions on the tube, and I started to think, this doesn't sound right. But the office was almost completely deserted, because I was based in London because I'd been working on this particular surveillance operation. But most of the team were actually in Gleneagles in Scotland, because the G7 was ongoing, and the intelligence that we had at the time, that there might be a terrorist attack at the G7. So most all of our assets were in Scotland, and there was very few of us in London actually when the bombing went off. It was completely unexpected. There wasn't any intelligence to suggest that there was anything ongoing. And so I was sort of sat there, and a bit like I was back in 1996, really. What the hell do you do? You know. So I phoned through to, we have like a special reserve room that's like the nerve centre of the anti-terrorist branch. And I phoned through to them and said, have you seen the news flash? And they said, yeah, well, we're monitoring it. We've spoken to the borough. It happened in a couple of different places. We've spoken to the borough. They've sent some officers to check it out. We're waiting to hear what's happened and whether we need to attend. So it was kind of, a bit odd, because a number of people were already dead. There had been a terrorist attack, but the anti-terrorist branch didn't know. You know, we had no idea it was a terror attack. And it wasn't until the first three bombs went off at 8:50 a.m. And obviously I started making my initial phone calls, trying to find out what was going on just after 9 o'clock. And it wasn't until the bus was blown up that we realised it was a terror attack, because there was no much communication coming from the people in uniform that had gone to the scene initially. They weren't they knew there'd been an explosion, but they weren't aware that it was a terror attack. But obviously the bus bombing really sort of, made it clear to us what we were dealing with. And so I went to, there was another team of people, not my team, but another team. And I said to the team, well, we need to sort of get ourselves sort of to the scene and sort it out. But obviously we didn't realise there was multiple scenes. But then we realised we didn't have any cars. And so we didn't have any transport to get there, because it was all in Gleneagles in Scotland. and so it was kind of cat and mouse, really. So I literally walked across the road, and across the road from our office, from the office that I worked at, there was a massive national car hire centre. And I walked across the road and walked into the office, and I said, I want to hire every car you've got on your forecourt. And he said, what do you mean? He said, well, he said, we've got 60 cars here. I said, I need all of them. I said, I need every single one. I haven't got an order form for you. But you know there's been a terror attack, but I need every set of car keys. And I basically commandeered every set of car keys he had. And then we sort of carried on for the next sort of 18 hours, really, until the rest of the team came back. So I spent some time organising that. And then sadly, I had to go to the bus bombing, and I don't talk about that much. And you know, we did some work there, and then the next sort of week really was spent tidying up the scenes and trying to track down the other victims, because what happens in a terror attack, it's not nothing simple, unfortunately. You know, members of the public, they get injured or they get bits of evidence blown onto them, and then they disappear off home and don't tell anyone. And a few days later, they might ring up and say, oh, I've seen your appeal on the television. I was there. Oh, really? Were you there? Yes, I was there. And I got covered in blood, and I've got all this, you know, somebody's, you know, blood all over me, and it's not mine. And one of the things they teach us, how we clear up scenes where bombs have gone off, is although bombs scatter things in tiny, tiny pieces, actually we can reconstruct and we can work out what a device is made of, because although it gets blown in tiny pieces, we literally pick up every tiny piece, and that's what we did every scene. We picked up all the tiny pieces, every bit of debris, every bit of bone, body, and we sorted it and put the devices back together and worked out what happened. But quite quickly we realised it was a suicide bombing, and there were four suicide bombers, and they left identification for us deliberately to find at the scenes, and they dropped them in bags away from where they'd actually exploded their devices, so that we could find them. And so then I was posted on, before that. So we spent some time in London. Then 2 weeks later, another group of guys who were loosely connected with the first then tried to do exactly the same thing again on three tube chains and a bus. And so I then spent 2 weeks hunting them down. And again, I don't talk too much about that. I was involved in naturally laying hands on certain individuals on that job, and we arrested those, and then the day after that, I was posted to the investigation team in Leeds, which is where three of the bombers lived, and that's where I spent the next 5 years really in Leeds, and sadly my youngest daughter was born the month before the bomb went off. I missed lots of her growing up, I did lots of traveling, you know, all across the country and speaking to different witnesses and traveling. I traveled different parts of the world as well, and investigating different suspects and who might be involved. And it was an amazing, amazing experience. I'm very tragic and sad. But it's exactly what I wanted to do. Going back to that day in 1996, standing in Canary Wharf and thinking, wow, I want to catch the people who did this. You know, here I was, and somebody was absolutely giving me the opportunity to have completely unprecedented access to the world of spies. Because normally what happens in counter-terror operations is the spies, you know, MI5, is they collect all the intelligence and then they only pass it to the police to deal with, actually, when they think a crime's been committed. And, you know, by the time normally we get it, there's not a great deal for us to do. We're almost like an arrest team. Just go and nick people and sweep up the evidence. But here we were. And MI5 had absolutely no idea what had happened and why and who was involved. And so I was given the opportunity to work in this team And I had unbelievable access to Thames House and MI5 and the spies and all their intelligence, and it was incredible. Biggest investigation that the country has ever known. I mean, the magnitude of it was absolutely incredible. It was like nothing I had ever experienced before at all. There's 15,000 witnesses, 60,000-70,000 exhibits. The magnitude of it was incredible. But quite quickly, we found that the sheer size of it was part of the problem. You know, trying to see the wood for the trees in many ways. You know, which of those witnesses are important? You know, who's going to read 15,000 statements? Obviously we had a computer system called Holmes, and these things were put in Holmes, but it was impossible. So I quite quickly identified the size of the investigation, the magnitude of it, and how we were going about it was one of the issues. And one of the things I want to talk to you about is obviously motivation. What happened in 7/7 was that we had lots and lots of really skilled people. You know, there were thousands at one point, thousands of detectives working on that investigation. But absolutely nobody had an idea. You know, the spies didn't know. They didn't know who had done it, really. You know, we had some names. But these four men had designed their lives over the 12 months before they carried out the bombings to make it look like they weren't friends with anybody. They'd completely disassociated themselves from anyone, really. They'd used different communication platforms, different telephones, to try and make it look like that they were the only ones that had done it. And I was absolutely convinced that that wasn't the case. But trying to, you know, wade your way through 15,000 statements and 70,000 exhibits and try and work out whether who else was involved, it was almost an impossible task.
So was it like they'd created this double life or this second persona? Yes. So they'd constructed their regular life and their normal life, and they were going about that to make it look like they were just doing their normal thing. But then they had this secret life on the side where they were doing all of this communication using something that was entirely just separate from their usual lives.
That's right. And how they'd done it is all the people that were potentially involved were obviously very well briefed. So that when we turned up on their doorsteps, they're like, "Well, I haven't seen Sadiq it must be 2 years now. You know, I haven't spoken to him, don't speak to him anymore. You know, I heard he was a bit of an extremist." And so we'd get this on the doorstep of people all the time. And it was very clever. It was really, you know, it almost worked. What we did have, because obviously we couldn't work out who was telling the truth and who was telling lies. You know, everyone was saying the same thing. And how do you work that out? You know, there's you've got no way of doing that. So we collected all of their personal telephone communications, all of their email addresses, and I literally went through 2 million lines of communication. I made it my goal to understand everything about their lives, who they were, who their friends were, where they liked to eat, what their favorite food was, where they went to school. I felt it was the only way. All we had to look backwards in time, because we didn't have any reliable witnesses, the only thing we'd have to look backwards in time was their communication, where they were when they made certain phone calls, where they were when they made when they sent certain text messages or used messaging platforms. And so I had to try and literally search for the needle in the haystack, because obviously 2 million lines of text is pretty difficult to look through. But I was spurned on, really, by people saying it couldn't be done. You know, it's impossible. We can't do it. And eventually I started to see patterns. You know, when you look at something, enough, and when you spend enough time with it, when you live it, when it becomes your life, and that's what it became. And that became an absolute obsession for me. That I had to, you know, there wasn't anyone else that was going to do it. It was down to me. And eventually I started to see the patterns in their communications, and the regular patterns, where they would talk to friends on regular phones, but then where they would talk to there'd be things that sat out of place. And when I saw something that looked a bit out of place, I'd go to that place and try and work out who it was that they were talking to. And eventually I did. I was quite fortunate in that one of these particular patterns that I noticed, it led me to a place, and I banged on a door, and I was immediately suspicious about this particular place because of what they'd been doing. You know, all of the bombers had been in the vicinity of this particular building. And I managed to track down the man that they were talking to, and he gave me a bit of a run around, but I was like, well, I want to have a look at, you know, the buildings you rent out. And he said, well, he said, actually, I'll let you into a secret. I do know Sadiq. And I'm like, oh, really? That's interesting. You know, bear in mind, I already knew. And I said, why do you know him? And he took me to this room, and he said, well, they rented this room off me. I said, really? And I walked in there, and there was a, we'd already found one bomb factory, but there was a, in this, what they'd done is they taped up the curtains to the wall so that people couldn't see in, because they needed a lot of ventilation, so they had to have the windows open, but they didn't want people seeing in, so they masked the curtains to the window frame. And I walked in there, and I was looking around, and I just caught sight of the tiniest piece of masking tape you could ever imagine. And I'm like, I got you. I absolutely got you. And I phoned up my SIO, and said, I said, I found the other bomb factory. We was pretty sure there were two. So I found it. And he said, well, what makes you say that? I said, well, I found a bit of masking tape. Found a bit of masking tape on. He's like that. He's laughed at me. And I said, honestly, I'm absolutely certain. I explained it to him. So I don't believe you. Just forget it. And I was adamant. And he eventually agreed to send me a very, very small forensic team to go over this particular room. Bearing in mind, this was at like 6 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, and everyone had gone home. The guy that turned up, he said, well, why do you think there's a bomb factory? And I said, there's a bit of masking tape up there, look. And then he laughed at me as well. And he said, well, how are you going to prove it? I said, well, there must be something in the carpet. Surely you must be able to take the carpet up and look at the carpet and see if there's anything in the carpet that might indicate that they were making explosives. And he said, well, that carpet's way too big. And I said, well, what about if we hoover it up? What about if we put a bag inside, a forensic bag inside a Hoover, and then we Hoover what's up? And he said, well, that's never been done before. And I said, well, does that mean it's impossible? And he said, I think it's impossible. And I said, well, of course. If somebody's telling me it's impossible, I'm going to prove it's not. So I literally went and bought a Hoover down the shops, and I took the bag out, and I put one of our special, you know, suitable forensic bags, and I hoovered up this stuff that was on the in the floor. And then we locked this place up, and I sent the bag off for analysis. And about 2 weeks later, I had a phone call from the SIO. He said, you need to come to a meeting. So I said, okay. So I went to this meeting. He said, Dick, who was the exhibits guy, said, Dick, can you start? And he said, right, yeah, we've analysed the contents of this Hoover bag. Normally we measure explosives in micrograms, but actually we found 1,000 times more explosives in the carpet than we would expect to. And he said, I'm surprised the Hoover going over it didn't make it go bang. And he said there's enough explosives in that bag to bring down the whole building. And so you know, these little things of people telling me that can't be done, that's not how it is. And that's really, you know, and I, and I you know, and I continued on in the 7-7 investigation for some years, really in that vein, trying to track down who else was involved and why they did it, and the motive behind it is what really fascinated me, because you know the bombers had their motives, but there was lots of other people that had very different motives to the bombers.
So let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, I just first of all want to pull out just a couple of things you said there, and the thing that I hear from you as you talk me through and explain this, the whole investigation, is just your tenacity, your determination, your unwillingness to accept that something cannot be done, or that you can't do it, or that just because it hasn't been done before doesn't mean that there is an innovative way of developing an investigation in a completely new way, because you were dealing with entirely new territory, a new way of something being done. I know you said you were pushed on and determined to solve this just because you were told that it couldn't be done. But was there any, you know, what were your instincts telling you? Why were you so determined to keep going when you were being told repeatedly that certain things weren't possible or couldn't be done? What was driving you?
Well, I mean, really and truthfully, there's two things. I mean, first of all, having met some of the families of people that were killed, and the bombers' families, and a lot of people don't talk about the bombers' family because it's almost like it's taboo. But one particular family, you know, I was very moved by. I won't talk about which one, but I was very moved by. You know, how they were, and they were extremely upset, and certainly, you know, the mum and the dad, and the brother had some idea, I think, but the mum and the dad were extremely upset, and I promised that I would get to the bottom of it. You know, I'd promised that I'd find out, you know, who turned their son into a mass murderer, and their son was a mass murderer, you know, and because they believed their son was a nice boy. And he was, you know, he was going to go on and do something good instead of murdering people with a bomb on his back on the 7th of July. So really, you know, there was, I'd lost my family. You know, I was living away from home. You know, I went home, you know, literally one day every 2 weeks. That's the only time I was allowed off. And so I was missing my family, but at least my family was alive. And so I think kind of what drove me on initially was with this feeling of, you know, someone's got to pay for this. Someone's got to pay for the pain that these people are going through. And I'm going through, you know, I was missing my daughter growing up. So that was really the sort of first thing. But there's also a part of my personality which makes me what I believe I'll use your words, a world class investigator, because one of the things that you need is an absolute unflappability and this tenacity, this drive to turn around and say, I don't care that we haven't done it before, or I don't care that you're telling me that this isn't going to work. I'm going to try it, and I'm going to do it. And if it fails, it fails, and I'll find another. I'll go and do it again. And you know, I'd always had that in all of the investigations that I'd done in the past. And you know, I had some experience of people saying, "Well, that's unsolvable. You know, we're never going to get the bad guys." And quite often, not all the time, but quite often, I'd find something that pitched me into where the bad guys were and who the bad guys were. And so I had this, you know, tenacity and drive, you know, from the families and within myself. And I think that's really what you need as an investigator. You know, when somebody's people talk about, you know, who inspired you to be a great investigator. I never had any inspiration. All I had was these detractors, these people telling me that you're not going to do it, or we're never going to get it, or, you know, just put the statements in homes and homes will tell us the answer. Well, that's never going to happen. You know, it's down to me. And so, you know, I would take personal responsibility for what I was up to. I would take personal responsibility for the job, and I'm going to get it done. And so that's really, I think, what you need as a as an investigator. You know, anyone that tells you, well, you need this skill and that skill, you can learn anything. But giving up, you know, giving up on anything is the wrong thing to do, and failing is probably the best thing that can happen to you. You know, keep failing at it. You know, keep having people say to you, you can't do that, or that's impossible. And they say that to me, keep saying, you tell me that, keep getting my face and tell me it, because I'm going to come back and show you you're wrong. And that's me, really, and that's what I think that's what a good investigator is somebody that every time somebody punches him in the face and he falls over, he gets back up and go, right, okay, let's do that again, and learn from that experience.
Partly nature, partly nurture, definitely just that unwillingness to quit until you have exhausted every single possibility, and even then. Keep going until the every single thing that's even possible to be done, even if it's never been done before, has been done.
That's right. When we investigate things, you know, we investigate anything, often, you know, we investigate in a way where we're told to follow the evidence. Mm-hmm. You know, you hear that a lot.
Yeah.
Follow the evidence, you'll solve the crime. Well, you know, take 7-7 as an example. We followed the evidence and it led nowhere.
Right.
You know, what do you do? You know, what do you do when somebody deliberately sets a trail for you to follow that leads nowhere? And that's what had happened. And a lot of criminals do this. A lot of criminals will, you know, they'll deliberately try and do things in a certain way so that the evidence will lead you nowhere. You know, the murder scene, you can work out how something's happened. The evidence tells you how it's happened, but it's the why. You know, that's what you're looking for in an investigator, I think. It's the why. That's right. Why has it happened? What's the motive? You know, yes, we know you go to a murder scene and you'll find, you know, a girl stabbed to death. It's a fairly chaotic attack. There's been a break-in. You know, there's no fingerprints, there's no friend evidence, there's no one else's blood, we found a knife. What do you do? You know, we've gone through her phone, we've spoken to her boyfriend, the boyfriend says, I wasn't there, I've got an alibi that night. You know, the evidence leads nowhere. What do you do? Well, you've got to think outside the box. Who was the killer? Somebody did it. You know, it's not unsolvable. And so, you know, we need to look at why. You know, what was the motive for this? And it's that tenacity, right? Okay, well, let's look at her finances. Let's understand who she was. What was she doing for the 6 months or 6 years that led up to her killings? Let's speak to every single person. But you know, sometimes we can't get there. But thinking outside the box is okay. It's like, well, how do we get to what the motive is? And you know, domestic murders are domestic murders. You know, the boyfriend might say that he's got an alibi. Well, let's look at the alibi. Let's secretly break into his current girlfriend's house and take some stuff from her house, or put a recording device in there and wait for him to come around and talk to her. And it's those sorts of sparks that a good investigator will be, well, let's try something. And somebody said, well, where are you going to get the evidence? It's like, okay, well, let's stick a recording device in the bedroom of his current girlfriend. Let's see if we can stimulate some conversation in there. Well, how are you going to do that? Well, I'll ring him up. We'll put some surveillance on him. We'll work out when he's there, and then I'll ring him up and I'll wind him up on the phone. You can't do that. Really? Can't I? Why can't I do that? And we ring him up and say, right, okay, we need to talk to you. And we wind him up on the telephone, and he puts the telephone down, and of course then he's gobbing off to his girlfriend about how bad the police are or whatever, and we end up with an admission on the tape in the girlfriend's bedroom. You know, it's those sorts of, you've got really got to be tenacious and not let go.
Right.
Everything is solvable, everything.
Yeah, because you're dealing with humans doing things to other humans typically. So you know, when you've got a person doing a certain thing, I really like what you said there, is that, you know, it's not necessarily about the what happened or how it happened or how it was done. It's the why. If you can figure out the why, it will lead you to the who.
That's right, exactly. And it will turn up those pieces of evidence that sit outside your crime scene, because the crime scene is, everyone thinks it's the holy grail. That's where you're going to find all your evidence. But, right. but really, it's often not. You know, if somebody's planned something well, you know, like the 7/7 bombers, they've deliberately planned something so mm-hmm. that it looks a certain way. You know, if you've got a killer that's worn gloves and he's not cut himself and he's put a disguise on, or, you know, there's no CCTV or anything to follow him from, what do you do when you've got a crime scene with just a body and a knife? Well, you know, what do you do? You go down the shops and find out where the knife was purchased or how many knives were sold, and find out there were 15 million knives of that type sold in the UK. We don't know where that one came from. You know, where do you go with that?
Yes.
It's those investigators who say, instead of saying, sitting there on their backsides in the office going, oh, that's that then, it's the guy that turned around and said, well, there must be more. You know, let's try this, or let's do this. And it is the motive that you're looking for. And when you can understand why people have done something, that's when you'll find the evidence that they weren't expecting you to find, because you're on a totally different trail. You're not following the evidence that they've left for you, because they've deliberately not done anything.
Yes.
So it's that you need. It's that tenacity and drive that you need as an investigator.
Amazing. That's it. It's so interesting and just... You know, honestly, I could talk to you all day. I'd like to talk about your books just for a couple of minutes. The books that you've written so far have been really. You mentioned right at the beginning in your introduction that these are really a way of you documenting or remembering, talking about, sharing your experiences through writing about it as a third party, or writing about it as a semi kind of fiction type book. Is that your plan to continue now as an author, to continue working on that kind of book, and to keep going down that kind of avenue of fiction, being a fiction writer?
Yeah, I mean, Stephen King, he got a great line, I always remember, and it's, fiction is the lie within which we tell the truth. And I love that, because one of the things I'm not allowed to do is I'm not allowed to talk to you about some of the things that I've done in my past.
Right.
You know, because the Official Secrets Act says I'm not allowed to. I can't tell you what you know I've listened to with the spies, or what I did with the spies, or what I did when I went to certain countries. Because I'm precluded from doing so. And if I do so, I break the law. However, the Official Secrets Act says that it's not allowed to interfere with my artistic rights. So as a writer, I am completely allowed legally to tell you a story, but I can't tell you the truth.
Right.
So that's why my strapline, or one of my sayings, is I can't tell you the truth, but I can tell you a story. And using Stephen King, I tell the truth through lies of fiction. So when you read my books, you get the realism. You know, somebody that has chased terrorists across rooftops, that has sat opposite somebody that's a mass murderer and lied through their teeth and tracked down bomb factories and tracked terrorists across the world and sat with the spies and listened to them on the telephone. You know, you get that realism from me, because I've done it. You know, I've done it all. I really enjoy writing, and I love immersing people in a world that most people don't even realize exists. Going back right to back to the careers officer who said to me, you can never be a secret agent. Oh, really? You know what? I came as close to being a secret agent as anyone ever can. And it would have been a crying shame, really. I never set out to be an author, but it would have been an absolute tragedy to have to have been that boy, you know, with the careers officer, being laughed at, and then having all these experiences and then letting them go to waste. So that's really why I penned my first book. I was approached by a couple of big companies that wanted to publish my book, but they wanted to change it. You know, they wanted to make it much more fiction based.
Right.
and I refused. You know, that first book was you know, me, and I wanted to tell the story. But it was such a raging success, much to my surprise, really, because I didn't realize I could do it, and so that's really it set me on the road to being an author. And I've written another book, The Detriment, and The Detriment is another real life investigation I was involved in, and it deals with the motive. You know, we talk about motive a lot, and I talk about motive a lot, but that's what my book deals with. It deals with the motive behind some of the things that we see on television, some of the things that we see every day, but we don't really delve too far in. Somebody driving a blazing Jeep into Glasgow Airport in 2007. And that's what The Detriment is about, is what really was behind that. Why did those people do that? And a bit like 7/7, we thought it was terrorism, but what if we were wrong? What if there is somebody or something that is controlling actually what's going on here? What's their motivation? Why are they doing it? It's not saying that the 7/7 bombers weren't radicalized religious nuts and boo themselves up because they thought they were going to get some virgins in heaven and they were going to go on to a better life. You know, they absolutely did. But somebody and something absolutely had them over. And that's really, you know, what I like to write about now. You know, when I look at other events and the other events I've investigated in my time, is that, you know, these motivations, these secondary motivations are fascinating. But once you get under the skin of one, you kind of, you know, it's like pulling on a set of night vision goggles. It's suddenly the darkness. You can see things in the darkness. And so, you know, I'm writing my third book, which I'm actually looking at right now. it's about a huge investigation. It's really exciting. I can't tell too much about it yet.
No, of course.
I implore anyone really to read my books and get under the skin of and understand, you know, some of the things that I experienced. You know, they're written from a one person's point of view. You know, my point of view. You get the evidence as an investigator would get the evidence. As investigators, we're not in the head of the killer when he's at the scene. You know, and he's telling you why he's doing it. An investigator turns up. He's got this awful looking body. He's got the blood everywhere, and he's got a load of hysterical witnesses. And that's how my books are written. It's written very much from the perspective of an investigator.
And it's so fascinating to people because it's a perspective that people don't get. And in fact, in most cases, the general public don't get either perspective. They don't get the perspective of the criminal necessarily, or the perspective of the investigator. But I would argue that there's probably more accounts out there, personal accounts written by people that have been serial killers, or accounts of serial killers, or people that have committed these heinous crimes, as opposed to the real life accounts or close to real life accounts of investigators that have worked on these types of horrific crimes and the lessons learned and just the way you described that crime scene as you went there initially, the way that these investigators piece every single little part of it back together, and the hundreds of thousands of pieces of evidence that you end up with, and as you mentioned, the millions of lines of text that you end up reading, just the amount of intelligence and information. And you know, you hear people saying quite a lot in the media that, you know, well, the information is out there. How could you not have found it? When something like this happens and it's known that there has been intelligence available. And I think one of the issues, and certainly one of the issues now, and, one of the things I wanted to mention to you was the intersection between technological and physical evidence. And even going back 13 years to the 7/7 bombings, the amount of data and information that we have now is exponentially more than it was even back then, before a lot of these social media channels were so popular and a lot of these chat apps were, commonplace for people. So I can only imagine now how much harder the job of those types of investigators are, people that are involved in terrorism.
I mean, one computer, bearing in mind that we all have a computer, hard drives are massive, but just 1 gigabyte of data, saved 1 gigabyte of saved data on a computer. I want to print it out. That's like 10 feet high.
Right.
And somebody's got to look for every single page.
Right.
That's the only way to know what is there. Obviously our mobile devices now, going back to 2005, we didn't have smartphones, we didn't have iPads, those sorts of things didn't exist. We had the really basic little telephones that sent text messages, and that was it. But like you say, now it's just becomes much, much harder. But in many ways, those create other opportunities for us. The technology creates amazing opportunities for investigators. I've been reading about some amazing cases about the Amazon Dots and the Amazon Echoes. Crime scenes. Have you seen those?
Yes, I have. And I, in fact, I've been involved in an investigation where that was very, very useful and actually led us in a particular direction because of instructions that had been given to one of these types of devices in someone's home.
Yeah, so whilst it makes it more difficult, it gives us opportunities. But, talking about what we had before is obviously the more information we have, we can sort of disappear under the weight of it and not see the wood for the trees, really. So it's really important to keep that focus and to try and maintain what it is that you should be looking for.
So final question, David, before we wrap this up, and just a quick, what would be the takeaway that you would give to new investigators or people that were coming out even of a career in the police and going into private investigation or investigation of a different kind? What's the best advice that you could give to somebody that's seeking a career as an investigator?
Well, really, it's nothing is unsolvable. Everything's solvable, and it is the only thing that stands between standing at the crime scene or wherever it is, or when somebody comes to you and says, whatever industrial espionage or whatever, whatever type of investigator you are, when somebody comes to you and says, right, I've got this problem, and the bloke next to you is saying, I don't know, there's nothing we can do about that. You've got to be the one that will turn around and say, no, I'm going to grab hold of that with both hands, and I'm absolutely going to own it and make it my own, and I'm going to solve it. And it's having that drive, that tenacity, and the enthusiasm, because some of it's really boring. You've spent years looking at stuff that's boring, years.
Yes.
But being an investigator is 90% boredom and 10% sheer fright. But it's that 10% that you live for, and you're never going to get to the 10%. You've got to work through the 90%. But you've got to have that drive, tenacity, enthusiasm, and to own what it is you're doing, and never give up. Never give up. Attitude. Love the fact that somebody's saying to you, you can't do that, or we can't solve it. Go to bed at night and dream about that person.
Right.
How do I get back at that person in the morning? I'm going to come up with an explanation or a reason to do it, and that's what you need. From my perspective, all of the things that we've spoken about throughout this whole conversation have got a common theme, and it's the common theme is never give up. When the careers officer said, I'm never going to be a secret agent, yes, I was. When my colleague said, well, we're never going to solve it, yes, I did. When the SIO says, you're never going to prove that was a bomb factory, yes, I did. When somebody said to me, you're never going to write that book, yes, I did write that book. When somebody says to me, you're never going to do that podcast for Julie, yes, I did. it's never given up, and that's what you need. That's what will define you as a world class investigator. That tenacity.
I love it. I really love it, David. Thank you so much. I've enjoyed talking to you so much, and I could honestly talk to you all day. I wish we were sat down over a beer instead of doing this on a podcast.
But, one day, Julie.
But we'll do that for sure. All right. Well, thanks so much, David. I really appreciate talking to you. Thank you for telling us about your books and your experiences. And if somebody wanted to get a hold of you to talk to you about your books or to find your books, are they for sale on Amazon or, how does somebody reach you?
Amazon. And any Amazon across the world, Amazon.com, Amazon.co.uk, Amazon.co, Canada, and Amazon Australia. But if you want to talk to me, I'm on Twitter at David Vadsett. I love to talk to people. But I've got a website, DavidVadsett.com, and there's lots and lots about me there, things I've done, and you can you could read all day, really, and go through all the news clips and see me talking about different things on the news, and there's literally hundreds of them, and I'm sure it will bore most people, but if you wanted to, it's there.
Fantastic. So you're very easy to find these days, and but for the next little while, you'll be sat in a room somewhere writing your book. So
absolutely,
yeah. Fantastic. All right, David. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your time today, and I will speak to you again soon, hopefully over a pint.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, all right.
Okay. Take care.
Thanks, David.
Well, once again, thank you for listening and for your incredible support. If you're not already a part of the World Class Investigator community, find me on Twitter at HuntedJulie, and I'll be happy to point you in the right direction. Until next time, take care.